So we've now come to the section of the Heart Sutra relating to the path of meditation. And we've just been briefly looking at the path of meditation in this Mahayana path chart. So as we see here, as with the path of seeing, we see these two sort of shaded areas, this uninterrupted path and liberated path. Meaning what we can see is that this is how we move from one level to the next, is through meditation, is that we're in our meditation on emptiness, and that direct realization of emptiness then becomes strong enough to wipe out the next level of ignorance and mental afflictions. And so then we, without interruption, we move on to having eliminated that next level of ignorance. We move to the liberated path and hence move to the next ground. So you can see this transition between each of the grounds in this way. So I think that's all I wanted to talk about this chart so far. So is there any questions on that which we've covered?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So each of these grounds, we are, of course, not only eliminating another layer of mental afflictions and ignorance, but we are also perfecting some positive quality. And so the first six are the six perfections. And each these the following ones, method, prayer, power, exalted wisdom, also are perfecting certain positive qualities. What they exactly mean, I can't remember now. I mean, when I studied this, of course, many years ago, there was a very extensive presentation about each of these 10 grounds and what is being perfected. So, I can't remember exactly what those four are relating to now. But if you are interested, there is a, in the Tibetan system, there is a text called Salam, Grounds and Paths, where a lot of this is discussed, and maybe even Lam Rim. I don't think the 10 grounds are discussed so much in the Lam Rim, but maybe I can try and find out and then later today or tomorrow maybe give a little answer to that. It'll be in my notes somewhere. At least it's in my notes, if not in my memory. any other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, I have two questions. First, what's the point, one of the milestones,
number seven.
Was that the point when you actually have reached samatha, or was that?
No, samatha. So remember, samatha is a concentration practice, and you can also develop much higher levels of concentration, these dhyanas, the four dhyanas and then the four absorptions. Those practices, of course, are not particularly Buddhist. I mean, there are many traditions that develop these levels of samadhi. But with respect to the Mahayana path, normally it's said that to enter the path of accumulation, to have this uncontrived bodhicitta, even to have that, you need a very stable, clear mind. So most commentators that I've read say that you would have developed samatha to some point before that. Some commentators say that you don't need samatha to have this bodhicitta uncontrived, but you need something quite close. And so even those commentators would say, even though maybe you don't have exactly samatha, you have something close, you will develop samatha at least on that first part of the path of accumulation. So, you know, it says small, middling, great level of path accumulation. So those commentators would, I think, go on to say that by the middle stage, you will have samatha anyway.
Second question. I read one of the Alan Watts' books.
Sure.
Saying that you can actually go through the ground level.
Go through
the grounds.
The grounds.
The path of meditation.
Yeah.
The path of meditation. That there are accounts where somebody has done it over days.
Oh, yes, there are different assertions. So first, what thing we need to remember is we can also have a similar path for the Theravada path to Nirvana. You can have something similar. You can map it out in a similar way. But in that path, normally they don't talk about the 10 grounds, but they still divide up the path of meditation into these 9 sections. And I think it's much easier to move through those stages than in the Mahayana path, because in the Mahayana path, you're doing also a lot of the positive qualities. So I think there's more effort required to move through this than in the equivalent at the Theravada level. So that's one point. And also, of course, within the Mahayana, particularly within the Vajrayana level of practice, then when we start to tap into more subtle levels of the mind, then that more subtle level of the mind is more powerful. We can accelerate the spiritual path. Which means that going through these stages, we can go through more quickly. But also, actually, when you look at the Vajrayana path to enlightenment, often that is also sort of divided up into 4 or 5 stages, but they don't really look like this. So, I don't know exactly what Alan Wallace was referring to when he said about moving through quickly. I'd have to look whether he's talking about,
I think he was talking about path meditation.
Right. Yeah. Again, there's no sort of fixed time for each of these sections. It would depend on the individual practitioner and their ability and commitment and so forth. So, you know, it could be that for some people they move more quickly than others, of course. There is that variation. But more than that, I couldn't really say unless I read what he wrote there. Okay. Yeah.
So, when you say Mahayana, all Buddhists, what you actually resolve is not to attain enlightenment before every other being has attained enlightenment. So, at which stage do you stop?
It's interesting, actually, first there's one thing I have to sort of try and dispel this confusion, is it's interesting, we talk about this Mahayana path, the Bodhisattva ideal for enlightenment, and, you know, then it's often said that the bodhisattva, keeps coming back to help others. And so sometimes people think that means that the bodhisattva doesn't want to get out of samsara. This is a big misconception. Of course the bodhisattva wants to get out of samsara, because while the bodhisattva's in samsara, they have mental afflictions, they have problems to help others in a good way. What these texts are saying is that a bodhisattva doesn't want to go to this goal of solitary peace, of nirvana, because there they can't be helpful. So when they say they want to keep coming back to help others, they're not talking about they trying to put off getting out of samsara. They're just saying they don't want to go to this solitary peace state of nirvana. So remember, this is not samsara. Samsara is not a place, it's a state of mind. So, of course, the bodhisattva wants to keep coming back in this world to help others, but the bodhisattva wants to get out of samsara as fast as possible so they can be more helpful. So that's one point. And then the second point was, again?
So we have these different grounds.
Yeah.
And offering here the 10th ground you attain enlightenment.
Right.
And then you are no longer a bodhisattva, but a Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say the bodhisattva's resolve is to make.
So of course, when we come enlightened, it's not like we disappear from this world. No, we keep coming back and back and back. So it's not like enlightenment means we end up somewhere else. And then actually there's, you said something about like, you know, trying to liberate everyone before themselves. When it comes to developing bodhicitta, it says there are three approaches. There's like the, what's the names there? There's the king-like bodhicitta, where we go first and then bring everyone with us. Then there's the second one is the boat, the oarsman-like bodhicitta, where we bring everyone with us. And then there's a third one is called the shepherd-like bodhicitta, where we try to put everyone in front of us. And it said that, of course, the third one is the most altruistic. But with that more altruistic motivation, you more quickly get to enlightenment first.
What is altruistic?
Altruistic, meaning putting others before you. Okay. Yeah. So they say that if you really have this third way of looking at bodhicitta, to try to put everyone else in enlightenment first, because it's so unselfish, that stronger motivation means you more quickly get to enlightenment.
But you really have to want it.
Yeah.
So the bodhisattvas don't necessarily... I was just wondering, like, do they, like, in this path of meditation, at some point, do they stop and say...
No, they want to get out of... They want to get to enlightenment as fast as possible. That's the whole purpose of Vajrayana. The whole purpose of Vajrayana is to get to enlightenment as fast as possible so that we can be more beneficial more quickly. Yeah.
So it's just a resolve, not a actual thing.
Actual thing.
Like,
well, I mean, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha, he's enlightened, but we're still stuck in samsara, aren't we? Where is he? Could be anywhere. He could be in this room. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Generally, in the text, when there comes up this sort of question, it said, of course, we all have Buddha nature. We all have the potential to achieve enlightenment. We all will have, we will achieve it at some point. But to speculate about a time when everyone's enlightened is not of any help to us at the moment. So we just do the best we can. That's usually how it's presented. Okay, let's go to the Heart Sutra now. So we're on the top of the second page. And it says, Shariputra, therefore in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. And then lists go on. And what we see here is that there are groups of lists here, which a lot of this is going back to right at the beginning of the uncommon prologue, when it said the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena. These are the categories of phenomena. So these are ways of grouping phenomena, particularly the functional phenomena. So in the first grouping, we see no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no composition factors, no consciousness. Of course, we've already covered that. That is the five aggregates. But here he says, in emptiness there is no this, no this. So, of course, if we look at this superficially, it seems to say that, according to the Buddha, none of these things exist. There's no form, there's no. But what we need to look at, of course, is the beginning. It says, in emptiness, there is no form. So what does it mean to say, in emptiness, there is no form, feeling, discrimination, composition, and cognizance? What this means is, in a direct realization of emptiness, at that time, there is no form appearing. So if we are in a direct realization of emptiness, the only thing appearing to us is emptiness. None of the conventional phenomena appear. Because remember, in a meditation on emptiness, we are coming to realize the ultimate nature of reality. And if the ultimate nature of reality was that things existed independently, it would mean that when we come to investigate the ultimate nature of these phenomena should be appearing if they were independently existent, if that was their ultimate nature. But because emptiness is appearing, then that is not the ultimate nature of these phenomena, that they're independent. So that is what is being indicated here, is that in a direct realization of emptiness on the spiritual path, only emptiness is appearing. No conventional phenomena is appearing. What that implies, of course, is none of these phenomena exist ultimately, independently. What this means, of course, is that as on the spiritual path, we have to alternate. You know, we either are absorbed into emptiness and the only thing appearing is emptiness, or we're in the phenomenal world trying to help others, and then of course we're not realizing emptiness. So we have to alternate between these two things. And the reason we have to alternate is we have these subtle stains, these cognitive obscurations. These cognitive obscurations, these subtle stains in our mind, are stopping us from seeing phenomena and their emptiness at the same time, because these stains are resulting in phenomena appearing to exist independent of us. That's why we have to do this alternation. And that's what this in emptiness means here. So again, on the path of meditation, we are familiarizing, cultivating this direct realization of emptiness again and again. And in that direct realization of emptiness, none of these things are appearing. So none of the five aggregates are appearing. So we've looked at the five aggregates already, so we don't need to look at those again. But let's look at these other categories of phenomena that follow, and there is some helpful information to be gotten out of some of these categories. So let's look at that. So the next categorization, the next grouping, comes with the next 12 things. We see no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. These are talking about the six sense faculties. So, of course, the first are the five sense faculties, and the sixth is what's called the mental faculty. And then the following six after that, no visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, no phenomenon, are the six sense objects. So again, the first five are the five sense objects, and no phenomenon is the mental object, the object of mind. So these 12 things together are called the 12 sources, or ayatana in Sanskrit. They're called the 12 sources because they are the source of consciousness. So again, we have these six sense faculties, or sense powers, sometimes they're called, and the six objects. And these 12 things together are the sources for generating consciousness. So let's have a look at that. For a consciousness to arise, we need three conditions. The first is called the empowering condition. The empowering condition is the sense faculty, The second condition is the observed object. So, of course, we need an object. So we need a sense faculty. We need an object. And then, of course, we need what's called the immediately preceding condition. And the immediately preceding condition is the consciousness. So let's use a simple example to understand these points here. So for a consciousness that is, for example, an example, the consciousness apprehending the cup, for that to arise, we need three things. We need the sense faculty, we need the object, and we need the immediately preceding condition, which is the immediately preceding moment of consciousness. So we have those three things coming together, meaning we have the current moment of consciousness then the sense faculty contacts the object, and then in the next moment, then is generated the consciousness apprehending this cup. So these are the three conditions that need to come together for us to have a perception of something, for consciousness of something to arise. Any questions about this? I think it's fairly straightforward.
Is this also called meeting in some places?
Well, of course, the sense faculty one of the mental factors at that time is contact. Comes into contact with the object, and then from that, in the next moment, we have the apprehension of the object. Yes. So these are what is this list of 12 things here. Is the first six are the six sense faculties. The second six are the six sense objects. Again, it's saying that in a direct realization of emptiness, none of these things are appearing. Which, of course, means, again, none of these things exist independently. As with the previous presentation, The Path of Seeing, explicitly, this is what's being presented. Explicitly, none of these are appearing, therefore none of these exist independently. Implicitly, it's presenting these categories of phenomena. It's presenting there are five aggregates. There are six sense powers, there are six objects, and there are these six consciousnesses that arise from these things. So implicitly, the 12 sources are being presented. And then if we go to the next list, which is being sort of reduced, there's not all of them are listed, it says, there is no I element and so on, up to and including no mind element and no mental consciousness element. So this here is another category of phenomena. So we've had the five aggregates, the 12 sources, and this is what's called the 18 constituents or elements. I think here it's translated as element. Sometimes it's translated as constituent, and the Sanskrit word here is dhatu. And the 18 elements or constituents are, again, the same six sense powers, the six objects, and then the six consciousnesses that are generated. Constituents, elements.
I'm
trying to say it myself. 16, 18 constituents or elements. Maybe constituents just sort of means parts, elements, you know.
Building blocks.
Yeah, because what we're saying here is These three presentations, the five aggregates, the 12 sources, and the 18 constituents or elements, these are all presentations of the same thing. They're all presentations of all functioning phenomena. So all functioning phenomena that exist can be divided into either the five aggregates, the 12 sources, or the 18 constituents. And so I think this word constituent or element is just saying that, you know, parts, yeah, in that way. Maybe there's a deeper meaning than that, but I think that's what it means. So again, the 18 elements are the six sense powers, the six objects, and then the six consciousnesses that are produced. So here again, we have the word consciousness. So remember I said that in general, consciousness and mind mean the same thing. But in very specific context, often the word consciousness takes on a more specific meaning. So we remember we saw in the five aggregates, we had the word consciousness. That word consciousness in the five aggregates is talking about just the main mind, part of the mind, as opposed to the mental factors. Here we have the six consciousnesses, which is the five sense consciousnesses and the mental consciousness. So here the word consciousness is talking about, again, an aspect of the mind, the visual consciousness, the auditory consciousness, you know, the mental consciousness. So the five sense consciousnesses and the mental consciousness. So again, we're using the word consciousness in that way. So all of these six together, of course, is the mind. We're not talking about six separate minds here. We're talking about six aspects of the one mind.
And can we say this 18 elements are kind of the same, you know? Because when you see eyes and visual, it's like...
Yeah. So we have the visual sense faculty contacting the visual object, and from that is produced the visual consciousness. Okay. Like that. Okay. That's why the list is like that. We have the mental power, or, you know, each sense power has its respective object, which produces the respective consciousness. That's why it's divided into that. So these are the, again, so no eye element, and so on up to, including no mind element, and no mental consciousness element. So the eye element up to mind element, of course, is talking about this. So it's saying, it's only listing the first and the sixth, and then it says all the way up to no mental consciousness element, which is the sixth consciousness here, the last one. So all the rest are sort of not mentioned explicitly, but that's what it's saying.
The sense power relates to sight.
Well, there's five senses.
Yeah, but that's an example.
Yeah. So an example
it's
of...
It's not the eye, but it's the sight.
It's the visual faculty, which enables a visual consciousness, yes. Yes. Okay. Then, if we move along to the next presentation, it says, there is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. So, of course, this is talking about the 12 links of dependent origination, which we're going to look at in some detail now, and we're going to use the last handout that you've got, the last page, this one here, the Wheel of Life, the Bhava Chakra. Yeah. So, of course, at the beginning stage of spiritual path, then to motivate us to do something with our life, then often it's recommended to reflect on two things. Precious human life, to reflect on the fact that we've got this wonderful opportunity, we've got lots of good conditions, let's not waste it. And together with that, to reflect on death in terms of this opportunity is not going to last forever. We don't know how long we're going to live, so let's not waste our life. So death at the beginning of spiritual path comes in that context of motivating us to really take use of our life. Here, of course, it's not really for that. This, what we're looking at here, the 12 links, is we are looking at how we are stuck in this cycle of samsara. So, you know, of course, the Buddhist assertion is that there's more than one life. There's life after life after life. And so, of course, part of that cycling is, you know, birth, aging, death, birth, aging, death. And so here we are looking at how we are caught in that cycle of birth, aging, and death. So here, when we talk about death, it's just part of the process, and so how we're stuck in this process here. But again, in the beginning of the path, to reflect on death is for the purpose of motivating us to make use of our life. So different reason. Yeah. Okay. So let's have a look now at this Bhava Chakra or Wheel of Life. So there's this, what's being mentioned in the Heart Sutra, of course, is talking about these 12 pitches around the outer edge of this diagram, these 12 links of dependent origination. And I'd like to look at those in some detail, but before I do that, let's sort of get an overview of this whole diagram, what it means. So this wheel is, of course, symbolizing this sort of cycle of existence called samsara. And we see that this is being held by this monster called Yama. So Yama is symbolizing the lord of death, or Yama is the lord of death. So he's symbolizing death and impermanence. You know, that we are trapped within the cycle of birth, aging, death. And see, we can see that Yama has got his teeth into the wheel, meaning we are literally trapped in the jaws of death, meaning we are trapped in this endless cycle of birth, aging, death, birth, aging, death, birth, aging, death. And the reason we're trapped in this cycle, we have to go right to the middle to understand that. So right in the middle of the diagram, we see these three animals, the pig, the rooster, and the snake. These are symbolizing these three poisons. So remember, the three poisons were the three core mental afflictions. The first of the three poisons was ignorance. You know, this ignorance, misunderstanding how we exist and the world around us exists. This ignorance grasping onto independent me, independent world. That ignorance is symbolized by the pig. Then we have the other two is attachment and aversion. The rooster is symbolizing attachment, and the snake is symbolizing aversion. And in this diagram, we have each animal grabbing the tail of the other animal. In a more traditional diagram, you often see that the pig is grabbing the tail of both the rooster and the snake, meaning out of the mouth of ignorance comes attachment and aversion. And we saw that in that suffering and its causes chart, that because of our ignorance, that leads to this attachment and aversion for pleasant and unpleasant experiences. But this is also okay because it's sort of implying that each one reinforces the other one. But again, you'll find in the more traditional diagram that the pig is grabbing both the tail of the rooster and the snake. So this is the underlying source of this cycle of existence. From, of course, our ignorance and mental afflictions, as we saw, these are driving our behavior, and our behavior can either be virtuous or non-virtuous, and of course our actions lead to consequence, have consequences, and our virtuous actions lead to a happiness result, our non-virtuous harmful actions lead to suffering result. And so these two types of actions are symbolized by the next circle out. So on the left side we see it's white. So this is symbolizing what's often called the white actions, which are the virtuous actions. And here in that white part, we see that the beings in there, or people, are moving upward, which is symbolizing the fact that if we do virtuous actions, we will sort of, figuratively speaking, move upward to a good future existence. Whereas if we do black actions on the right, they are symbolizing harmful, non-virtuous actions, we will, figuratively speaking, move downward to a future, more suffering type of experience. And so we see the beings there on that side moving in a downward direction. Now, what types of existences can we find ourselves in? That is the next section out, which is divided here into five sections. Again, more traditionally, you would see it's divided into six sections, which are often called the six realms. So let's have a look at these five or six sections and see what they refer to. So if we go up sort of from 12 o'clock to 2 o'clock, up the top on the right a little bit, we see there's some humans there with some houses and so forth doing various things. So this is symbolizing the human realm, the human type of existence. And then if we go over from sort of 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock on the left there, we see some animals and birds. And down the bottom, I think there's supposed to be some fish down there as well. So, of course, this is the animal realm, the animal type of existence. And then if we go up to sort of from 10 o'clock to 12 o'clock, we see actually two groups of people, one a little bit above the other. And in a more traditional diagram, we would have a line in the middle there between the two groups. Because these are two different types of existences, but quite similar. So that's why here they're sort of not divided into two. The upper group of people there, this is called the Deva realm. And so, of course, all of this is mentioned on the page opposite. And so the Deva realm, in the Deva realm, the beings there really have very a lot of pleasure. They have bodies made of light. They don't have such coarse bodies as we do. Bodies made of light, immense sense pleasure, and live a long time. And so, therefore, sometimes the word Deva is translated into English as God realm. But, of course, this is not the same idea as the Christian idea of a creator God, only to symbolize the fact that the beings here have very much light bodies, a lot of pleasure, and live a long time. Then, a little bit below in the same section, the other group of people here, or beings, are called the Asura realm. They also have bodies of light and a lot of pleasure, live a long time, but not quite as much pleasure as the Devas. So sometimes the word Asura is translated as demigod, meaning like half a god, half the pleasure. And here we see them sort of firing arrows at each other. And that symbolized sort of the fact that the Asuras are a little bit jealous of the Devas because they have more pleasure. And that's also symbolized in the middle of the diagram. We see a tree. And at the base of the tree where the roots are is in the Asura realm. But the top of the tree where all the fruit is in the Deva realm. So they get all the fruit and the Asuras sort of miss out. So that's sort of symbolizing that. So these are then these two realms, the Deva and Asura realm. Then if we go from like 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock Over again on the right in the middle, we see some beings here that having some big bellies, and some of them have a little bit of fire coming out of their mouth. Not looking like they have a very pleasant time. This is called the Preta realm. And in the Preta realm, the beings are really quite struggling just to stay alive, to even get the basic necessities like food and drink and so forth. And so as a result of that, the word Preta is sometimes translated as hungry ghost or hungry spirit realm. And then if we go down the bottom between 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock, we see lots of flames and torture, looking like a lot of suffering there. So this is symbolizing what's called the Narak realm. And in the Narak realm, there is quite a lot of physical suffering symbolized by these flames and so forth. And so as a result, the word Narak sometimes translated into English as hell realm, but again, it's not really the same idea as the Christian idea of hell. So these are the six realms, six types of existences that are possible within samsara. Now, of course, we can ask the question, you know, are these actual types of existences, or are they merely some sort of psychological state within the human realm? Of course, two of the six we can confirm with our own direct observation. We can confirm that the human realm and the animal realm actually exist. And of course, some people claim to be able to see some of these other types of beings, devas, asuras, preta beings, even narak beings. So for some other people, they also have direct experience of these other types of beings. Personally, I never had a direct experience of any of these beings. But of course, when we look at these six types of existences, we can see that they're not some crazy idea, because we can relate to these certainly within the human realm, that really a lot of people really live like animals. And we can see how much poverty and starvation there is in the world, and so how many people are really living as preta beings. And we only have to look at all the war-torn areas of the world today to see how much of a narak realm exists in many areas of the world. And then, of course, some individuals do, in fact, have immense sense pleasures in their life. So we can relate to the deva and asura realm in that way. But of course, from the Buddhist perspective, these are actual realms of existence. And actually, if we can appreciate this view of reality we're looking at in the Heart Sutra, the idea of emptiness, it means there is no fixed, objective, independent world out there. That the world of our experience is really a product of our mind. And where do our experiences come from? Comes from our actions. So these worlds are not sort of, you know, the Narak realm is not some place underground here somewhere. Rather, it's simply an experience. And again, there is no objective independent world there. It's a product of our mind. So, you know, there's not a lot of difference between us being having a heavy suffering experience as a human and having a narak type experience. The only difference being is our experience of suffering, heavy suffering, maybe just lasts not so long, and we sort of see this type of body, whereas a narak being, maybe the suffering lasts, the same type of experience lasts maybe a bit longer or quite a lot longer, and the body looks a little bit different. But again, it's all a product of the mind. So there's not much difference between an actual realm and having that experience as a human. Not much difference at all, according particularly to this Majjhimika understanding of reality. So these are the six realms. One or two more things and then we'll look at the 12 links. So outside of all of this, of course, up the top right we see the Buddha, meaning the Buddha has managed to achieve liberation from samsara. And he's up there and he's pointing across, of course, to his right, over to the left top of the diagram. In a more traditional diagram, in the top left-hand area of there, you would see a moon in the sky. And a moon is symbolizing nirvana. Because often the word nirvana can also mean like this cooling of the torment of the mental afflictions. And so, of course, the sun torments us with heat, whereas the light of the moon has this sort of cooling effect. It's not tormenting us. So therefore, nirvana is often symbolized by the moon. Here in this diagram, of course, we see some writing here. I think it looks a bit Tibetan-like. And I think this is the actual Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha to help us to transcend samsara. There's a little round thing on the top. I'm not sure if that's supposed to be the moon or not. But again, more traditionally, you would just see the moon there, symbolizing nirvana. So that is a little bit the diagram. We're going to look at the 12 links now, but one more point before we do that, and that is that the history of this diagram is a little bit related to the Heart Sutra, actually. You know, we said that the Heart Sutra is part of the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, and it took place in Rajgir, this vulture's peak just outside Rajgir. And of course, Rajgir was the residence of the king. That's what Rajgir literally means. And the king at the time, I think I briefly mentioned, was King Bimbisara. And King Bimbisara was one of the disciples of the Buddha. And the Buddha spent a lot of time in that area before and after enlightenment. And so King Bimbisara actually appears in a number of different sutras. And what happened was at one point, the King Bimbisara, he received a gift from a neighboring king. I think some sort of precious gift. I can't remember what it was. It may have been some sort of jeweled coat or something with immense value, precious gems and jewels. And then King Bimbisara wanted to give something back to the other king. I think his name was King Udayana, of equal value, but he couldn't think of anything of equal value in his own kingdom. So it said he went to the Buddha and said, well, what can I give to King Udayana of equal value to what I received? And it said that the Buddha commissioned the drawing of this diagram. He gave this to King Bimbisara and said, give this to King Udayana. This is of much more value than what you received. And it said that he gave this to King Udayana, who really contemplated in this and on the basis of this actually achieved nirvana and became an arhat. So that's the history of this diagram. So let's now look at these 12 links, which are mentioned in the Heart Sutra, but any questions before we go there to the 12 links? Well, we can look at it two ways. So, again, we can talk about what's called the three realms. We can talk about these three realms, the desire, form, and formless realm. And these are sort of higher planes of existence. Of course, we are stuck in the desire realm, and it's given the name desire because that is the fundamental driving force in this existence we have, is desire and attachment for the sense pleasures. And remember at the time of the Buddha, it was often felt by some of these traditions at that time that the reason we're suffering is because of this craving and desire, particularly for the body. And so we need to transcend, go beyond this craving and attachment, desire. And one way of at least subduing desire is to develop samadhi. So actually, when we develop shamatha, if we're in the middle of a shamatha experience, our mind has transcended that. So the mind of shamatha is actually belonging to the form realm. So if we're in that shamatha state, we have temporarily, in that experience, transcended desire. But not in terms of eliminated, but because of the concentration, desire won't come up. Then, within the form realm, these are these four dhyanas. They're higher levels of concentration that we can develop. And if we develop one of these four dhyanas as a human, this can act as a cause for us to end up in that plane of existence in the future life. So we can now, in meditation, have that mental experience of this subtle state. But also, because of that, that can create a cause for us to be actually reborn in that very subtle existence in the next life. And that is the form realm. And, you know, in the Theravada, we talked about the four Brahma Viharas, the abode of Brahma. That's also here within this form realm. But then we can go on to develop higher levels of concentration called these four absorptions, where we're really absorbing our mind away from any form. And if we do those, we achieve those four formless absorptions, we can also end up being born in that sort of formless realm, where there's no discrimination of form at all. That's why it's called formless. So there are four levels here and four levels here. So these are called the three realms. Now, within the wheel of samsara here, these six types of existence is also called six realms, generally are within the desire realm. Because unless we can develop some high level of samadhi, we simply cycle amongst all of these six. We're stuck in the desire realm. But sometimes, you know, the word deva, this god realm, sometimes that word deva here, people use it not only to refer to devas within the desire realm, but also these beings that live in these realms. So sometimes then the word deva includes these two types of beings. But generally, I think the six realms are simply talking about the desire realm. Yeah. Well, see, what it is that these are higher and higher levels of samadhi, yeah? And so when we're in the form realm here, it's seen like discriminating form is very coarse. It's very coarse. So in the first stage here, it's called infinite space. So we absorb into a state where we just discriminate space because form is seen to be very coarse. That's right. It's similar in that we go beyond mental afflictions, but it's only a temporary state because it's only concentration. So in fact, a lot of the traditions, and that's what Prince Siddhartha first did when he left the palace, is a lot of the yogis at the time were thinking that if they develop this, they will get to nirvana. But, and so Prince Siddhartha did these absorptions. He got to the top of the pile and he saw that, no, it's temporary. I'm not out of samsara. So what he discovered was samadhi won't get us out of samsara. All it'll do is it'll temporarily sort of keep the lid on our mental afflictions. When that effect wears off, the mental afflictions will pop back because we haven't gotten rid of them.
Also create the cause for the next birth.
It can, depending on our motivation.
But then that next birth will not be a temporary one.
Yes, it will. Yeah. The time spent in these different realms can be quite long, but it'll finish. Because it's an imprint that ripens that will run out. So the beings here, maybe compared to us, live a long time, but they will come out of those experiences and then they'll end up back down here somewhere. And so I think from the Buddhist perspective, sometimes a lot of these gods that are talked about are simply beings here. They're not out of samsara. And that's why this is called the Brahma realm, as an example, one of the levels here.
The barometer is like a tiger.
Yes, there's this sort of tiger skin at the bottom. So far, I haven't found anyone who can give me a good explanation as to what that means. Within Tantra or Vajrayana, sometimes you see people sitting on tiger skins. And in a Vajrayana perspective, I think that means to have subdued or transformed anger. But here, of course, we're not talking Vajrayana or Tantra, so it doesn't have that significance here. So I haven't found anyone who can give me a good explanation for that. In an earlier life.
Yeah.
Yeah, that he, yes. I mean, it could be that, but I don't think so. I mean, it doesn't sort of make so much sense, does it? In this, the wheel is, or it's actually Yama sitting on the tiger. It's not the Buddha. So, and Yama is the Lord of Death. So, I keep asking various people, but I've never got a good answer.
So, the Buddhas and, I think the Buddhas, they also, delve in a realm, like Tushita, the name Tushita corresponds to, sanctuary Buddha Maitreya is in his teachings.
Yeah. Right, so there's also talk, particularly in the Mahayana, about these types of realms, and there are two types, there are two different ones. Some of them are actually talking about very high levels here in the form realm. And some of them are talking about what's called like Buddha paradise or something, which is just enlightened state. Yeah. So we need to be careful when we hear these words about these types of realms. Some of them are still within samsara in a very subtle level of existence within the form realm. And some of them are talking about, what's called the Buddha realm. But, you know, where is this Buddha realm? Well, if we achieve enlightenment, this is our Buddha realm. Now we're, this is samsara for us. So it's not like, oh, there's a Buddha realm over on the back of the hill there somewhere on this cloud. Yeah. So we need to be a little bit careful about that. Otherwise we have some strange ideas about these Buddha realms. You know, where are they? Like I said, if we now sit and achieve enlightenment, this becomes our Buddha realm.
Formless and form realms.
Yeah.
It's possible to get a rebirth in them.
Possible, only through samadhi.
For a limited period. Yeah. Again, falling back into the wheel.
Yeah. Well, they're within the wheel, really, but. Fall back to desire realm, yes.
When we talk about the path, the Mahayana path, then permanent students.
Permanent, meaning you...
Sustaining.
Well, let's not use the word permanent. Let's say they're states that you won't fall back from. Yeah, correct.
Then still, you will not remain in the wheel.
No, you're outside the wheel.
Outside.
Yeah, sure.
So it's possible to be in these states within the wheel and outside the wheel?
No. You mean, what do you mean? These states?
The form and formless.
No, this is a type of existence within samsara. This is all samsara.
But it can be equated to nirvana and enlightenment in a brief.
No. These are all types of existence within samsara.
I read about in the Kingdom of Snow, the book of the New Power, she talks with the king spirit, or something like that. That's in the Edema.
Yeah. So, again, when we see within Tibetan Buddhism, and we better stop there, we're running over time, you know, we talk about spirits, not deities, that's something different, but spirits and so forth. And sometimes also we talk about these Dharma protectors, you know, to help protect us in our practice. And in Tibetan Buddhism, they appeal to a lot of these beings or spirits to help them in the Dharma practice. And again, there are two types of these beings. One is enlightened beings, and others are ones that are stuck in samsara, but a little bit more advanced than us, and they can be helpful to us. So it can be both. It can be referring to a being within one of these places in samsara, but of course in a better condition than us, or it can be referring to enlightened being. I think generally, in this case, the first option. Yes.
Not in
a human form, no. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, maybe they're in like one of these deva realms or form realms or in that way.
And how could you communicate?
How can you communicate? I mean, there are many... But there are many people who claim to be able to communicate with these types of beings, no? And... from a Buddhist perspective, we can develop that capacity ourselves to be able to communicate with these, because remember they have a much more subtle level of existence. So for us, it's not so easy, but we can develop that capacity.
So they can help you from their realm.
Yeah, well, because they can communicate with you then. I mean, generally it's said those types of beings can see this realm all the time, but we can't see them. So there's sort of like a one way, it's only a one way thing. So we can't benefit. So if we can connect with some of these beings, then we can help us if they're more spiritually advanced than us, of course. Okay, we better stop there. We're running over time.